out of cordite smoke, grinning from ear to ear with mirthless delight. Nick is the one who finds the egress to the roof, and Philip is the one who gets the idea to deposit all the rotting carcasses up there so they don't stink up the place any further, or make the scavenger hunt through the upper floors any more unpleasant than it has to be. It takes them little over an hour to drag all the inhuman remains up the stairwell to the third floor, and then up through a narrow stairwell to the fire door. They have to shoot the lock off, and have to work in a sort of modified bucket brigade, dragging the smelly flesh sacks down the hallways and up two flights of stairs to the roof, leaving leech trails of gore on the cabbage rose carpet runners. They managed to get every last one of them. They terminated 14 of them altogether, going through two entire clips of 22 caliber rounds as well as half a box of shells, up the passageway and onto the roof.
"Look at this place," Nick marvels, as he puts the last carcass down on the tar paper warning track along the east side of the roof, the wind whipping his pant legs and tossing his hair. The corpses lie in a row like cordwood lined up for the winter. Brian stands at the opposite end of the file, gazing down at the dead things with a strange, implacable expression on his face.
"Pretty cool," Philip says, walking over to the edge of the roof.
At this height, he can see the distant buildings of the exclusive Buckhead area, Peachtree Plaza, and the glass cathedral of skyscrapers to the west. The frozen spires of the city rise in pristine summits, impassive, stoic in the sunlight, untouched by the apocalypse. Down below, Philip sees the scattered, wandering dead moving in and out of shadows like broken toy soldiers come to life.
"Cool place to hang out," Philip says,
turning and surveying the rest of the roof. Around a giant conglomeration of antennae, rent tracks, and heating and air conditioning machinery, now cold and powerless, an apron of pea gravel offers enough space to play a touch football game. A forgotten tangle of lawn furniture leans against an air duct.
"Grab a chair and take a load off."
The dragged, tattered chaise lounges over to the edge of the roof.
"I could get used to this place," Nick says,
settling down on a lounger facing the skyline. Philip sits down next to him.
"You mean the roof, or this place in general?"
"All of it."
"Copy that."
"How do you do it?"
Brian says, standing behind them, fidgeting with nerves. He refuses to sit down, refuses to relax. He's still wired from his encounter with the impaled head.
"Do what?"
Philip says.
"I don't know. Like the killing and stuff. And then the next minute you're..."
Brian stops himself, unable to put it into words. And Philip turns and looks at his brother. He sees the man's hand shaking.
"Sit down, Bri. You did good down there."
Brian pulls a chair over, sits down, wrings his hands, ruminating.
"I'm just saying."
Again, he can't articulate what he's just saying, and he falters.
"It ain't killing, sport," Philip says. "Soon as you get that straight, you're gonna be fine."
"What is it, then?"
Philip shrugs.
"Nicky, what would you call it?"
Nick is staring out at the skyline.
"God's work?"
Philip is a big laugh at that one, and then says,
"I got an idea."
He gets up and goes over to the closest corpse, one of the smaller ones.
"Check this out," he says,
and drags the thing over to the edge of the roof. The other two join Philip at the ledge. The rancid wind tosses their hair as they gaze over the ledge at the street 35 feet below them. Philip shoves the cadaver with the toe of his boot until it slips over the side. The thing seems to fall in slow motion, its limp appendages flopping like broken wings. It strikes the cement parkway down below in front of the building and comes apart with the sound, color, and texture of a very ripe watermelon erupting in a starburst of pink tissue. In the master bedroom of the first floor apartment, David Chalmers is sitting in his wife-beater t-shirt and boxer shorts,
sucking on an inhaler, trying to get enough atrovent into his lungs to quell the wheezing, when he hears the commotion outside the boarded sliding glass doors of the rear portion of the apartment. The sound instantly raises the hairs on his neck, and he quickly fumbles himself into his clothes, including the breathing tube, which he gets halfway on, one side dangling under a hairy nostril. He storms across the room on creaking knees, yanking the oxygen tank along on its casters like a stubborn child being pulled by an impatient nanny. Crossing the living room, he catches a glimpse out of the corner of his eye of three figures standing rapt and terrified at the threshold of the kitchen. April and Tara had been making cookies with the little girl, using up the last of their flour and sugar, and now the three females stand there, gaping in the direction of the noise. David hobbles over to the boarded, meshed, burglar-barred sliding doors. Through a narrow gap in the plywood planks, in between the branches of skeletal trees, he can just barely see the far end of the courtyard, and beyond that, a slice of the street running parallel to the front of the apartment building. Another body rains down, as if dropped by God himself, hitting the pavement, making a wet, lurid, smacking sound, not unlike a giant water balloon popping. But that's not the noise that's getting to David Chalmers right now. That's not the noise that's penetrating the apartment, coming in waves. A vast, distant, tuneless symphony.
"Sweet jumping Jesus,"
he mutters in a breathy wheeze, whirling around so fast he nearly tips over the tank in its caddy. He drags the thing toward the door. On the roof, Philip and Nick pause after heaving the fifth body off the ledge. Panting from the effort and a sort of morbid giddiness, Philip comments,
"They blow up good, don't they?"
Nick is trying unsuccessfully not to laugh.
"This is 10 counts of wrong, but I gotta admit, it feels good."
"You got that right."
"What's the point, guys?"
Brian wants to know, standing behind them.
"The point is, there is no point," Philip says without looking at his brother.
"What is that, like a Zen saying?"
"It is what it is."
"Okay, now you lost me. I mean, I don't see how throwing these things off the roof is accomplishing anything."
Philip turns and gives his brother a look.
"Lighten up, sport.
You bagged your first trophy today. Wasn't pretty, but it got the job done.
We're just blowing off a little steam."
Nick sees something in the distance that he hadn't noticed until now.
"Hey, check out—" "I'm just saying," Brian interrupts. "We gotta keep our wits about us and shit."
He has his hands in his pockets, nervously kneading the change and the penknife that he had stashed in there.
"April and her family are good people, Philip. We gotta behave ourselves."
"Yes, Mom,"
Philip says with a cold smile.
"Hey, you guys check out that building down there in the corner."
Nick is pointing at a squat, ugly brick edifice on the northeast corner of the closest intersection. Blackened around the edges with the fumes of the city, the faded letters painted above the first floor display window say, "Dillard's Home Furnishings." Philip sees it.
"What about it?"
"Look at the front corner of the building. There's a pedestrian thing."
"A what?"
"A walkway or a breezeway, or whatever you call it. See it?"
Sure enough, Philip sees a grimy glass bridge spanning the adjacent street, connecting the office building catty corner to them to Dillard's second floor. The glass-encased footbridge is empty and sealed at either end.
"What are you thinking, Nicky?"
"I don't know."
Nick stares at the pedestrian bridge, pondering.
"Could be..."
"Gentlemen!" The husky boom of the old man's voice interrupts. Brian turns and sees David Chalmers trundling toward them from the open stairwell door. Urgency burns in the old man's eyes, and he drags his oxygen tank along with a practiced limp. Brian takes a step toward him.
"Mr. Chalmers, did you get all the way up here by yourself?"
The old man is breathing hard as he approaches. Through his wheezing, rattling breaths, he says,
"I may be old and sick, but I ain't helpless. And call me David. I see y'all cleaned out them floors real nice and tidy, and for that I thank you. I truly do."
Philip and Nick turn and face the man.
Is there a problem? Philip asks.
Hell yeah, there's a problem, the old man says, eyes flashing with anger. What you been doing up here pitching them bodies off the roof like that? You're just cutting off your own feet!
What do you mean?
The old man lets out a grunt.
Y'all deaf or something? You can't hear that!
Hear what?
The old man shuffles out to the edge of the roof.
Take a gander.
He points a gnarled finger at two buildings in the distance.
You see what you done?
Philip gazes off to the north. And all at once he realizes why he's been hearing that infernal noise of 1,001 moans for the past 15 minutes. Legions of zombies are migrating toward their building, most likely drawn to the noise and spectacle of bodies hitting the pavement. Maybe 10 or 12 blocks away now, they move with the undulating slither of blood clots traveling down arteries. For a moment, Philip can't tear his eyes away from the hideous migration. They're coming from all directions, percolating through the shadows, oozing out of alleys, choking the main drags. They meet up in multiplied intersections like a great amoeba growing in size and strength, inexorably drawn to the catalyst of humans in their midst. Philip looks away finally and pats the old man on the shoulder.
How bad, David? How bad?
That night, they try to eat dinner and pretend that it's just an ordinary meal among friends. But the persistent clawing noises outside the building keep killing the conversation. The sounds are a constant reminder of their exile, of the mortal threat just outside their door, of their isolation. They tell each other their life stories and they try to make the best of it. But the menacing noises keep everybody on edge. Considering there are 17 other apartments in the building, they'd expected to harvest a bounty of provisions from the upper floors that day. But all they found was a few dry goods in the pantries, some cereal and hard pasta, maybe half a dozen cans of soup, a bunch of stale crackers, and a few bottles of cheap grocery store wine. It had been weeks now since the building lay abandoned, without power, infested with the dead, and all the food had rotted. Maggots crawled in most refrigerators, and even the bedding and the clothes and the furniture had mildewed and soured with the stink of zombies. Maybe folks took their essentials with them when they fled. Maybe they took all the bottled water and batteries and flashlights and wooden matches and weapons. They left their medicine cabinets untouched, though, and Tara manages to collect a shoebox full of pills, tranquilizers like Xanax and Valium, stimulants like Adderall and Ritalin, blood pressure meds, diet pills, beta blockers, antidepressants, and cholesterol medications. She also finds a couple of bottles of bronchodilators that will serve the old man well. Philip gets a kick out of Tara's flimsy pretense of being concerned for everybody's health, when he knows full well she's mostly interested in anything that'll provide her with a recreational buzz. And who the hell can blame her? Pharmaceutical relief in this situation is as good an escape as any. The truth is, by that second night, despite the constant din of the undead outside their windows, the Chalmers family has begun to grow on Philip. He likes them. He likes their bohemian country style. He likes their pluck. And he just plain likes being with other survivors. Nick also seems re-energized by the union of the two families, and Penny is actually talking again, her eyes clear for the first time in weeks. The presence of other females, in Philip's estimation, is just what the doctor ordered for his daughter. Even Brian, his chest cold almost completely gone now, seems stronger, more confident. He still has a long way to go, in Philip's humble opinion, but he seems galvanized by the possibility of some kind of community, no matter how small and ragged. The next day, they begin settling into a routine. From the roof, Philip and Nick keep track of the zombie quotient on the streets, while Brian checks the weak spots around the first floor, the windows, the fire escapes, the courtyard, the front foyer. Penny is getting to know the Chalmers sisters, and David mostly keeps to himself. The old man is battling his lung disease as best he can, He naps and takes his inhaler and visits with the newcomers as much as possible. In the afternoon, Nick starts working on a makeshift catwalk, which he plans to run between the roof of the apartment building and the roof of the neighboring structure. He's got it in his head that he can make it to the pedestrian bridge at the corner without ever having to set foot on ground level. Philip thinks he's crazy, but tells him to go ahead and waste his time if he wants to. Nick believes this maneuver is actually the key to their survival, especially since they're all secretly concerned. You can see it on the face of anyone who goes into the kitchen. They'll soon run out of supplies. The water is turned off in the building, and carrying bucketfuls of human waste from the bathroom to the back window overlooking the courtyard for dumping is the least of their problems. They have a limited supply of water, and that has everybody very worried. After dinner that night, at a little after about 8 o'clock, when an awkward silence in the conversation reminds everybody of the unrelenting noises coming from the dark outside, Philip gets an idea. "Why don't you all play something for us?" he says. "Drown those bastards out."
"Hey," Brian says, his eyes lighting up. "That's a great idea."
"We're a little rusty,"
the old man says from his rocker. He looks tired and drawn tonight, the sickness working on him.
"If you want to know the truth, we haven't strummed a note since this all started up."
"Chicken,"
Tara remarked from the couch, rolling a number with the flecks of tobacco, seeds, and stems at the bottom of her little Band-Aid canister. The others sit around the living room, ears perking up at the prospect of hearing the world-famous Chalmers Family Band.
"Come on, Daddy," April chimes in. "We can play the old rugged cross for him."
"Nah. They don't want to hear no religious claptrap occasions such as this."
Tara's already maneuvering her portly self across the room toward her gigantic bass fiddle case, her makeshift cigarette dangling from her lip.
"You name it, Daddy. I'll slap a bass line to it."
"Oh, what could it hurt?"
David Chalmers relents as he levers his creaking body out of the rocker. The Chalmers dig their instruments out of their cases and then tune up. When they're ready, they seem to position themselves in a tight formation before they begin, as synchronized as a Marine drill team, with April in front on guitar and David and Tara on the flanks and back on mandolin and bass, respectively. Philip can just imagine them on the stage at the Grand Ole Opry, and he could see Brian soaking it all in across the room. One thing about Brian Blake, he knows his music. Philip's always marveled at his brother's depth of knowledge on the subject, and now, with this unexpected boon, Philip figures that Brian must be delighted. They start playing. Philip gets very still. It feels as though his heart is suddenly being inflated with helium. It's not just the stark and unexpected beauty of their music. That first number, a lovely old Irish jig with a sad thumping bass line and a rolling guitar pattern that sounds like a 100-year-old hurdy-gurdy. Nor is it the fact that sweet little Penny seems suddenly transported by the melody as she sits on the floor, her eyes going all dreamy. Nor is it the fact that a simple, delicate tune in the face of all this ugliness practically breaks Philip's heart. It's the moment when April begins to sing that floods Philip's soul with electric honey. "There's a shadow on my wall, but it don't scare me at all. I'm happy all night long in my dreams." As clean and crisp as a glass bell with perfect pitch, April's spectacular velvety alto voice rings in the room. It caresses the notes, and even has a hint of the church in it, a slight soulful sauciness that reminds Philip of a choir singer in a country chapel. In my dreams, I'm happy all night long in my dreams. I'm safer in my bed, happy thoughts are in my head, and I'm happy all night long in my dreams. The voice awakens an aching desire in Philip, something he hasn't felt since Sarah died. He has X-ray vision all of a sudden. He can see little things about April Chalmers as she strums her six-string and warbles joyously that he hadn't noticed before. He sees a tiny anklet chain around her ankle, and a small tattoo of a rose inside the crook of her arm, and the pale half-moons of her breasts, as white as mother of pearl, between the bunched buttons of her blouse. The song comes to an end, and everybody applauds. Phillip's clapping the most vigorous of all. The next day, after a meager breakfast of stale cereal and powdered milk, Phillip notices April off to herself near the front door, putting on her hiking boots and wrapping the sleeves of her sweatshirt with duct tape. "Thought you might like a second cup," Phillip says to her innocently, coming up to her with a cup of coffee in each hand. "It's instant, but it ain't half bad." He notices her wrapping her ankles with tape. "What the hell are you doing?" She looks at the coffee. "You use the rest of that gallon jug for that?" "I guess so. We got one more gallon to last the seven of us until the 12th of never." "What you got in that head of yours?" "Don't make a big deal out of it." She zips up her sweatshirt and tightens the rubber band on her ponytail, tucking it into the hood. "I've been planning this for a while, and I want to do it myself." "Planning what?" She reaches into the front coat closet and pulls out a metal baseball bat. "We found this thing in one of the apartments. Knew it'd be useful one day." "What are you doing, April?" "You know that fire escape ladder on the south side of the building?" "You're not going out there by yourself." "I can slip out 3F, climb down the ladder, and draw the biters away from the building." "No. No. Draw them away long enough to go get supplies and slip back in." Phillip sees his own filthy lager boots by the door, where he left them the night before. "Mind handing me those boots?" he says. "If your mind's made up, you sure as shit ain't doing this alone." Chapter 12. Once again, it's the smell that first jabs him sharply in the face as he leans out the south window of apartment 3F. A coppery gumbo of human waste slow-cooked in bacon fat. An odor that is so horrendous it makes Phillip flinch. His eyes start watering as he shimmies through the opening. He doesn't think he'll ever get used to that smell. He climbs out onto a rusty ramshackle cast-iron landing. The platform, which is connected to a ladder that zigzags down 3 floors to a side street, wobbles under Phillip's weight. His stomach lurches with the sudden shift in gravity, and he braces himself against the rails. The weather has turned dreary and damp, the sky the color of asphalt, with the northeast wind curling through the distant concrete canyons. Luckily, down below, a minimum number of biters are roaming the narrow side street running along the south side of the apartment building. Phillip glances at his watch. In roughly 1 minute and 45 seconds, April is going to be risking her life in front of the building, and this urgency gets Phillip going. He quickly climbs down the first flight, the rickety ladder groaning with his weight, trembling with each step. As he descends, he senses the silver eyes of dead things noticing him, drawn by the metallic rattle of the ladder, their primitive senses tracking him, smelling him, sensing his vibrations like spiders sensing a fly in their web. Dark silhouettes, glimpsed in his peripheral vision, start lazily shuffling toward him, more and more of them coming around the front of the building to investigate. "They ain't seen nothing yet," he thinks as he drops to the ground, then runs across the street. 65 seconds. The plan is to get in and get out quickly, and Phillip moves along the boarded storefronts with the stealth of a Delta Force Marine. He reaches the east end of the block and finds an abandoned Chevy Malibu with out-of-state plates. 35 seconds. Phillip can hear the shuffling footsteps closing in on him as he crouches behind the Malibu and quickly slips his backpack off. His hands don't shake as he digs out the 16-ounce bottle of Coke filled with gasoline. April had found a spare plastic tank of gas in the apartment building's basement maintenance room. 25 seconds. He twists the cap, stuffs in the gas-soaked rag, and shoves the pointed end in the Malibu's tailpipe, letting a 12-inch length of rag dangle. 20 seconds. He digs out a Bic lighter, sparks it, and sets the rag alight. 15 seconds. He runs away. 10 seconds. He makes it across the street, brushing past a cluster of biters and into a dark alcove, diving behind a row of garbage cans before he hears the whoomp of that first eruption, the bottle catching in the tailpipe, followed by a much bigger explosion. Philip ducks and covers as a sonic boom shakes the street and sends up a fireball that turns the shadows into well-lighted places. Right on time, April thinks as she crouches down in the shadows of the foyer, the concussion blast rattling the glass door. The light popping overhead is like an unseen photographer's strobe. She peers out through the bottom half of the barred door and glimpses the sea change in the ocean of dead. Like a moving tide of ragged, livid faces, shifting with the gravitational tug of the moon, they start following the noise and light, heading in a disorganized mass toward the south side of the building. Tinsel shimmering in the sun couldn't attract a flock of sparrows better than this explosion works on these biters. Within a minute or so, the street in front of the building is practically deserted. April girds herself. She takes a deep breath. She secures the straps of her duffel bags. She closes her eyes. She says a quick, silent prayer. And then she springs up, yanks the cross brace, and shoves the door open. She creeps outside. The wind tosses her hair, and the stench strangles her. She stays low as she darts across the street. The sensory overload threatens to distract her. The smells, the proximity of the horde half a block away, the thunderous beating of her heart as she frantically moves from dark storefront to dark storefront. Thankfully, she's familiar enough with the neighborhood to know where the convenience store is located. If measured by the clock, it only takes April Chalmers 11 minutes and 33 seconds to slip through the jagged maw of broken glass and visit the ransacked interior of the convenience store. Only 11.5 minutes to fill 1.5 canvas bags with enough food and water and miscellaneous stuff to keep them going for quite a while. But to April Chalmers, those 11.5 minutes feel suspended in time. She grabs nearly 20 pounds of groceries from the convenience store, including a small canned ham with enough preservatives to keep until Christmas, 2 gallons of filtered water, 3 cartons of Marlboro Reds, lighters, beef jerky, vitamins, cold remedies, antibacterial ointment, and 6 extra-large rolls of blessed toilet paper, throwing it all in her duffel bag with lightning speed. The back of her neck prickles as she works with constant awareness of the ticking clock. The street will fill up again soon, and the army of biters will block her path if she doesn't get back within minutes. Philip goes through another half a clip of .22-caliber rounds, working his way back around the rear of the apartment building. The majority of the biters are now clustered around the flaming debris of the Malibu, a riot of moving corpses like June bugs drawn to the light. Philip clears a path around the back of the courtyard by squeezing off 2 shots. One of them cracks open the cranium of a lumbering cadaver dressed in a running suit, the zombie dropping like a puppet whose strings have been cut. Another blast opens a trough in the top of a skull belonging to what looks like a former homeless woman, her geode eyes flickering out as she falls. Before the other biters have a chance to close in on him, he vaults over the rear fence of the courtyard and charges across the leprous brown grass. He climbs up the back wall of the building, using an awning as a foothold. A 2nd fire escape ladder is folded halfway up the stucco wall of the 1st story, and Philip gets a grip on it and starts to pull himself the rest of the way up. But all at once he pauses and has 2nd thoughts about the plan. April reaches the critical point in her mission. 12 minutes have elapsed since she emerged, but she risks visiting one more merchant. Half a block south, an Ace Hardware store sits empty, its display windows broken, its burglar gates loose enough for a smallish woman to negotiate. She slips through the gap and enters the dark store. She fills the remainder of the 2nd canvas bag with water filters for making the standing water in toilets drinkable, a box of nails to replenish their supply, which they used securing the barricades, markers and rolls of large format paper for making signs to alert any other survivors, light bulbs, batteries, a few cans of Sterno, and 3 small flashlights.
On her way back toward the front of the store, now lugging nearly 40 pounds of merchandise and 2 bulging duffels, she passes a figure slumped at the end of a side aisle stacked with fiberglass insulation. April pauses. The dead girl on the floor, slumped and leaning against the far wall, is missing one leg. From the snail trail of gore leading across the floor, it's clear that the thing dragged itself here. The dead girl isn't much older than Penny. April gapes for a moment. She knows she has to get out of there, but she can't tear her gaze from the pathetic, ragged corpse sitting in its own juices, which have obviously leaked out of the blackened stump where its right leg used to be. "Oh, God, I can't," April says under her breath to herself, uncertain what it is she can't do. Put the thing out of its misery, or leave it to suffer for eternity in this deserted hardware store. April pulls the metal bat from her belt and sets down her packs. She approaches cautiously. The dead thing on the floor hardly moves, just slowly gazes up with the trembling stupor of a fish dying on the deck of a boat. "I'm sorry," April whispers, and buries the end of the bat in the girl's skull. The blow makes the wet, snapping noise of green wood breaking. The zombie folds silently to the floor. But April stands there, closing her eyes for a moment, trying to will the image from her mind, an image that will probably haunt her for the rest of her life. Seeing the shank of the bat cleave open a skull is bad enough. But what April just saw in the horrible brief instant before she brought the bat down, as she was drawing it back, winding up, was this. Either through some meaningless flicker of deadened nerves, or through some deeper understanding, the dead girl turned her face away in that moment before the bat arced down. A noise near the front of the store gets her attention, and she hurries back to her duffel bags, throws the straps over her shoulders, and starts toward the exit. But she doesn't get far. She slams on the brakes when she sees a second young girl blocking her path. It stands 15 feet away, just inside the mangled burglar screens, in the identical soiled dress as that of the girl April just dispatched. At first, April thinks her eyes are playing tricks, or maybe it's the ghost of the girl she just put down. Or maybe April is losing her mind. But as the second dead girl starts shuffling down the aisle toward April with black drool falling off its cracked lips, this one has both its legs, April realizes that it's a twin. It's the other girl's identical twin. "Here we go," April says, drawing back the bat, dropping her load, preparing to fight her way out. She takes one step toward the pint-sized monster, raising the bat, when a dry popping blast rings out behind the twin and April blinks. The bullet shatters a corner of the front window and takes off the top of the twin's head. April flinches back at the kick of blood mist as the girl collapses in a heap. April lets out a pained sigh of relief. Philip Blake stands outside the store, out in the middle of the empty street, clicking a new magazine into his .22 caliber Ruger. "You in there?" he calls. "I'm here. I'm okay. I know it ain't polite to rush a lady, but they're coming back." April grabs her treasures and then leaps over the bloody remains blocking the aisle and slips through the burglar gate and out into the street. Instantly, she sees the problem. The throng of zombies is returning, coming around the corner with the collective fervor of a demented chorus line moving in haphazard formation. Philip grabs one of the bags, and they both make a run for the apartment building. They cross the street in seconds flat, with at least 50 biters on either flank. Brian and Nick are peering out the reinforced glass of the outer vestibule door when they see the situation in the street rapidly changing. They see wolf packs of zombies coming down the street from both directions, returning from wherever the hell they had just gone. In the midst of all this, 2 human beings, 1 male and 1 female, like ball carriers in some obscure, surreal, twisted sport, come charging toward the apartment building with duffel bags slung and bouncing against their backs. Nick perks up. There they are. Thank God, Brian says, lowering the Marlin shotgun until the butt rests on the floor. He's shaking. He shoves his left hand in his pocket and he tries to get a grip on himself. He does not want his brother seeing him shaking. Let's get the door open, Nick says, leaning his shotgun in the corner. He gets the door open just as Philip and April are roaring up the walk, a multitude of biters on their heels. April roars through the doorway first, shaking and hyperventilating with adrenaline. Philip follows her in, his dark eyes aglow with testosterone-fueled mania. That's what I'm talking about! Nick slammed the door just in time. Three biters crash into the outer glass, rattling the steel-impregnated door, their drooling mouths leaving streaks. Several pairs of milky white eyes gazing through the greasy glass at the people in the foyer. Dead fingers claw at the door. Other biters are staggering up the walk. Brian has a shotgun raised at the figures outside the door. He backs away. What the hell is going on, man? Where were you guys? Nick ushers them through the inner door and into the foyer. April drops her bulging duffel. Jesus, that was close. Philip sets down his pack. Girl, you got some cojones, I'll give you that. Nick steps up. What's the idea, Philly? You guys just disappear without telling anybody? Talk to her, Philip says with a grin, shoving his Ruger inside his belt. We were totally freaking out, Nick rants. We're about 1 second away from going outside to look for you. Calm down, Nicky. Calm down! We were turning the place upside down looking for you. Ty was about to have a shit fit. It's my fault, April says, wiping the grime from her neck. Look at our take, man. Philip indicates the loot stuffed into the bags. Nick has his fists clenched. Then we hear a fucking explosion? What are we supposed to think? Was that you guys? Did you have something to do with that? Philip and April exchange a glance, and Philip says, that idea was kind of both of ours. April cannot stifle her victorious grin as Philip takes a step toward her, raising his hand. How about a high five, darling? They high-five each other, with Nick and Brian staring in disbelief. Nick is about to say something else when a figure appears on the other side of the foyer, pushing through the inner door. Oh my God! Tara storms into the room and goes to her sister. She pulls April into a bear hug. Oh my God, I was so freaked! Thank God you're okay, thank God, thank God! April pats her sister. I'm sorry, Tara. It was something I had to do. Tara lets go, her face flashing with anger. I ought to beat the shit out of you! Seriously! I'm telling that little girl you're just upstairs, but she's getting as freaked as I am. What am I supposed to do? That was a goddamn stupid, irresponsible thing to do, which is so goddamn typical of you, April. What the hell does that mean? April gets into her sister's face. Why don't you say what you mean for once? You fucking bitch! Tara winds up like she's gonna slap the younger woman when Philip suddenly steps in between them. Whoa there, Tonto. Philip gives Tara a reassuring pat. Hold on a second. Take a deep breath, sis. Philip nods toward the duffel bags. I want to show you something, okay? Just cool your pits for a second. He kneels down and unzips the bags, displaying the contents. The others stare silently at the supplies. Philip straightens back up and looks Tara in the eyes. That fucking bitch there saved our asses today. There's food and water in there. That fucking bitch risked her ass, not knowing if she'd be able to pull it off and not wanting anybody else to get hurt. You ought to be kissing that fucking bitch's feet. Tara looks away from the duffel bags and looks down at the floor. We were worried, that's all, she says in a feeble, low voice. Nick and Brian are now both kneeling by the duffel bags, looking through the treasures. Philly, Nick says, I have to admit, you guys kicked ass. You guys rock, Brian mutters almost under his breath with awe as he rifles through the toilet paper and the beef jerky and the water filters. The emotional atmosphere in the room begins to shift with the slow certainty of clouds parting. Smiles appear on all their faces. Soon,
Even Tara is throwing grudging glances over their shoulders at the contents of the duffel bags. Any cigarettes in there? Here's 3 cartons of Reds, April says, leaning down and digging out the cigarettes. Enjoy them, you fucking bitch. With a good-natured smile, she hurls the cartons at her sister. Everybody laughs. Nobody sees the small figure standing across the room in the inner doorway until Brian glances up. Penny? You okay, kiddo? The little girl pushes the door open and walks into the foyer. She's still dressed in her pajamas, and her little peaches and cream face is chiseled with seriousness. That man in there? Mr. Chalmers? He just fell down. They find David Chalmers on the floor of the master bedroom, amid a litter of tissues and medications. Granules of broken glass from a fallen aftershave bottle sparkle like a halo around his trembling head.
Jesus! Daddy!
Tara kneels by the fallen man, pulling his oxygen tube free. David's grizzled face is the color of nicotine as he involuntarily gasps for air, a fish out of water trying to breathe the poisonous atmosphere.
He's choking!
April hurries around the other side of the bed, checking the oxygen tank, which lies on the floor on its side near the window, tangled in its tubing. The old man must have pulled it off the bedside table when he fell.
Daddy, can you hear me?
Tara gives the man's ashen face a series of quick, light slaps.
Check his tongue. Daddy! Daddy!
Check his tongue, Tara! April rushes back around the bed, the oxygen tank and a coil of tubing in her hands. While she does this, the others, Philip, Nick, Brian, and Penny, watch from the doorway. Philip feels helpless. He doesn't know whether to jump in or just watch. The girls seem to know what they're doing. Tara gently levers open the old man's mouth, looking down his gullet.
It's clear.
Dad! April kneels on the other side of him, positioning the tiny breathing apparatus under his hooked nose.
Daddy, can you hear me?
David Chalmers keeps silently gasping, the back of his throat clucking painfully like a record skipping. His eyelids, as ancient and translucent as a mayfly's wings, begin fluttering. Tara frantically feels under the back of his skull for signs of injury.
I don't see any bleeding, she says. Daddy!
April feels his forehead. He's ice cold.
Is the oxygen running?
Full blast.
Daddy!
April gently repositions the old man so he's lying supine with the oxygen tube across his upper lip. Again, they give him little slaps.
Daddy! Daddy! Daddy, can you hear us? Daddy!
The old man coughs, eyes fluttering. He blinks. He tries to get a good lungful of air, but his shallow breaths keep hitching in his throat. His eyes are rolled back in his head, and he appears to be only semi-conscious.
Daddy, look at me,
April says, her hand gently turning his face toward hers.
Can you see me? Let's get him on the bed,
Tara suggests.
Phyllis, you mind giving us a hand?
Philip, Nick, and Brian step into the room. Philip and Nick take one side of the old man and Tara and Brian the other, and on the count of 3, they carefully lift the old man off the floor and lay him on the bed, making the spring squeak and tangling the tube on one side. Moments later, they have the tube clear and the old man covered in blankets. Only his pale, sunken face is visible above the linens, his eyes shut, his mouth lolled open, and his breathing coming in fits and starts. He sounds like a combustion engine that refuses to turn over. Every few moments, his eyelids flutter and something flickers behind them, lips stretched into a grimace. But then his face goes slack. He's still breathing. Barely. Tara and April sit on either side of the bed, stroking the lanky form under the blankets. For a long while, nobody says anything. But chances are, they're all thinking the same thing.
You think it's a stroke?
Brian asks softly, minutes later, sitting out by the sliding glass doors.
I don't know. I don't know.
April paces the living room, chewing her fingernails while the others sit around the room watching her. Tara is in the bedroom at her father's bedside.
Without medical attention, what chance does he have? Has anything like this ever happened before? He's had trouble breathing before, but nothing like this.
April stops pacing.
God, I knew this day was going to come.
She wipes her eyes, which are moist with tears.
We're on the last tank of oxygen.
Philip asks about medication.
We got his medicine, sure, but that ain't gonna do him much good now. He needs a doctor. Stubborn old coot blew off his last appointment a month ago.
What do we have in the way of medical supplies? Philip asks her.
I don't know, we got some shit from upstairs. Antihistamines and shit.
April paces some more.
We got first aid kits, big deal. This is serious. I don't know what we're gonna do.
All right, let's stay calm and think this thing through. Philip wipes his mouth.
He's resting peacefully now, right?
His airways are clear.
You never know, something like this, he could bounce back.
But what if he doesn't?
She stops moving and looks at him.
What if he doesn't bounce back?
Philip gets up and goes over to her.
Listen, we gotta keep our heads clear.
He pats her shoulder.
We'll keep a close watch on him. We'll figure something out. He's a tough old bird.
He's a tough old bird who's dying,
April says, a single tear tracking down her face.
You don't know that,
Philip says, wiping the tear from her cheek. She looks at him.
Good try, Philip.
Come on.
Good try.
She looks away. Her crestfallen expression is desolate as a death mask.
Good try.
That night, the Chalmers girls sit watch at their father's bedside, their chairs drawn up on either side of the bed, a battery-powered lantern painting the old man's pallid face in pale light. The apartment is as cold as a meat locker. April can see Tara's breath across the room. The old man lies there for most of the night in stony repose, his hollow cheeks contracting periodically with his labored breathing. The grizzled whiskers of his chin look like metal fillings, shifting in a magnetic field, moving occasionally with the ticks of his stricken nervous system. Every once in a while, his dry, cracked lips will begin to work impotently, trying to form a word. But other than little dry puffs of air, nothing comes out. At some point in the wee hours, April notices that Tara has dozed off, her head down on the edge of the bed. April grabs a spare blanket and carefully drapes it over her sister. She hears a voice.
Lil?
It's coming from the old man. His eyes are still closed, but his mouth is working furiously, his expression furrowed with anger. Lil is short for Lillian, David's late wife. April hasn't heard the nickname in years.
Daddy, it's April,
she whispers, touching his cheek. He recoils, his eyes still closed. His mouth is contorted, his voice slurred and drunken with nerve damage on one side of his face.
Lil, get the dogs in. There's a storm coming. A big one. A nor'easter.
Daddy, wake up,
April whispers softly. Emotion wells up inside her.
Lil, where are you?
Daddy?
Silence.
Daddy?
At this point, Tara is sitting up, blinking, startled at the sound of her father's strangled voice.
What's going on?
She says, rubbing her eyes.
Daddy.
The silence continues. The old man's breath's coming hard and fast now. The word sticks in April's throat as she sees something horrible crossing the old man's face. His eyelids flick open to half-mast, the whites of his eyes showing, and he begins to speak in an alarmingly clear voice.
The devil has plans for us.
In the gloomy half-light of the lantern, the two sisters exchange mortified glances. The voice that comes out of David Chalmers is low and gravelly, an engine dieseling.
The day of reckoning is drawing near. The deceiver walks among us.
He falls silent, his head lolling to one side of the pillow, as if the wires to his brain had been abruptly cut. Tara checks his pulse. She looks at her sister. April looks at her father's face, his expression now slackened and relaxed into a sanguine, tranquil mask of deep and endless sleep. With the morning's light, Philip stirs in his sleeping bag on the living room floor. He sits up and rubs his sore neck, his joints stiff from the cold. For a moment, he lets his eyes adjust to the gloomy light, and he orients himself to his surroundings. He sees Penny on the sofa, cocooned in blankets, sound asleep. He sees Nick and Brian across the room, also encased in blankets, also asleep. The memory of the previous evening's death watch returns to Philip in stages. The agonizing, hopeless struggle to help the old man and to assuage April's fears. He glances across the room. In the shadows of the adjacent hallway, the door to the master bedroom is visible in the gloom, still closed. Climbing out of his sleeping bag, Philip hurriedly and silently gets dressed. He pulls on his pants and pushes on his boots. He runs fingers through his hair and goes into the kitchen to rinse his mouth out. He hears the murmur of voices behind the walls. He goes over to the bedroom door and listens. He hears Tara's voice. She's praying. Philip knocks softly. A moment later, the door clicks open and April is standing there, looking as though someone threw acid in her eyes. They're so bloodshot and wet that they look scourged.
"Morning," she says in a low whisper.
"How's he doing?"
Her lips tremble.
"He ain't."
"What?"
"He's gone, Philip."
Philip stares at her.
"Oh, God."
He swallows hard.
"I'm real sorry, April."
"Yeah, well."
She starts to cry. After an awkward moment, a wave of contrary emotions punching through Philip's gut, he pulls her into an embrace. He holds her and he strokes the back of her head. She trembles in his arms like a lost child. Philip doesn't know what to say. Over April's shoulder, he can see into the room. Tara Chalmers is kneeling by the deathbed, praying silently, her head down on the tangled linen. One of her hands is lying on the cold, gnarled hand of her late father. For some reason that Philip can't figure out, he finds it difficult to take his eyes off the sight of the girl's hand caressing the bloodless fingers of the dead.
"I can't get her to come out of there."
April is sitting at the kitchen table, sipping a cup of weak, tepid tea brewed on a Sterno can. Her eyes are clear for the first time since she came out of the death room that morning.
"Poor thing. I think she's trying to pray him back to life."
"No shame in that," Philip says.
He sits across the table from her, a half-eaten bowl of rice in front of him. He has no appetite.
"Have you thought about what you want to do?"
Brian asks from across the kitchen. He stands at the sink where he's pouring water, which was collected from some of the toilets upstairs, into filter canisters. The sounds of Nick and Penny playing cards in the other room drift in. April looks up at Brian.
"Do about what?"
"Your father. You know, like,
burial-wise?"
April sighs.
"You've been through this before, haven't you?"
she says to Philip. Philip looks at his uneaten rice. He has no idea if she's talking about Bobby Marsh or Sarah Blake, both of whose deaths Philip recounted to April the other night.
"Yes, ma'am, that's true."
He looks at her.
"Whatever you want to do, we'll help you do it."
"Of course we'll bury him."
Her voice breaks a little bit. She looks down.
"I just never pictured myself doing it in a place like this."
"We'll do it together," Philip says. "We'll do it right and proper."
April looks down, a tear falling into her tea.
I hate this.
We gotta stick together, Philip says without much conviction. He says it because he doesn't know what else to say.
April wipes her eyes.
There's a patch of ground out back under the...
A sharp noise from the hallway interrupts, and all heads turn. A muffled thump is followed by a crash, the sound of furniture overturning. Philip is out of his chair before the others even realize that the noise is coming from behind the closed door of the master bedroom.
Chapter 13. Philip kicks the door open. Advent candles on the floor. The carpet burning in places. The smoky air vibrating with screams. A blur of movement smears across the darkness, and it takes breathless nanoseconds for Philip to realize what he's looking at in the flickering shadows. The overturned dresser, the source of the crashing noise, has landed inches away from Tara, who's on the floor, crawling with animal instinct, trying desperately to pull herself free of the vice grip of dead fingers on her legs. Dead fingers. At first, just for an instant, Philip figures something got in through a window. But then he sees the withered form of David Chalmers, completely turned now, on the floor, on top of Tara's legs, digging yellowed fingernails into her flesh. The old man's sunken face is livid now, the color of mold, his eyes frosted with glassy white cataracts. He snarls with a ravenous, guttural groan. Tara manages to extricate herself and struggles to her feet, and then slams sideways into the wall. Right then, many things happen at once. Philip realizes what's going on, and that he left his gun in the kitchen, and that he has a limited amount of time to eradicate this threat. That is the key. The fact that this kindly old mandolin player is long gone, and what this is. This hulking mass of dead tissue rising up and growling a garbled, drooling cry is a threat. More than the flames licking across the carpet, more than the smoke already forming a nightmarish haze in the room, this thing that has materialized inside their sanctuary is the biggest threat. A threat to all of them. At this same moment, before Philip has a chance to even move, the others arrive, filling the open doorway. April lets out an anguished yelp, not really a scream, more like a shriek of pain, like an animal getting gut shot. She pushes her way into the room, but Brian grabs her and holds her back. April writhes in his arms. All this happens in the space of an instant, as Philip sees the bat. In all the excitement on the previous night, April had left her Hank Aaron autographed metal baseball bat in the corner by the barred window. Now it sits gleaming in the flickering flames, maybe 15 feet away from Philip. There's no time to consider the distance or even map out a maneuver in his mind. All he has time to do is make a lunge across the room. By this point, Nick is whirled around and is racing across the apartment for his gun. Brian tries to pull April out of the room, but she's strong and she's frantic and she's screaming now. It takes Philip mere seconds to cover the distance between the door and the bat, but in that brief span of time, the thing that was once David Chalmers goes for Tara. Before the large woman can get her bearings and flee the room, the dead man is upon her. Cold, gray fingers ply themselves awkwardly toward her throat. She slams back against the wall, flailing at it, trying to push it away. Rotting jaws part, rancid breath wafting up in her face. Blackened teeth gape open. The thing goes for the pale, fleshy curve of her jugular. Tara shrieks, but before the teeth have a chance to make contact, the bat comes down. Up until this moment, especially for Philip, the act of vanquishing a moving corpse had become an almost perfunctory deed, as mechanical and obligatory as stunning a pig for the slaughter. But this feels different. It takes only 3 sharp blows. The first one, a hard crack to the back temporal region of David Chalmers' skull, stiffens the zombie and arrests its progress toward Tara's neck. She slips to the floor in a paroxysm of tears and snot. The second blow strikes the side of the skull as the thing is involuntarily turning toward its attacker, the tempered steel of the bat caving in the parietal bone and part of the nasal cavity, sending threads of pink matter into the air. The third and final whack totals the entire left hemisphere of its skull as the thing is falling, the sound like a head of cabbage smashed in a drill press.
The monster that was David Chalmers lands in a wet heap on one of the spilled candles, the ribbons of drool, blood, and gluey gray tissue hitting the flames and sizzling across the floor. Philip stands over the body, out of breath, his hands still welded to the bat. Almost as punctuation to the horror, a high-pitched beeping noise begins to shrill. Battery-operated fire alarms across the first floor are loudly chirping, and it takes Philip a second to identify the sounds in his ringing ears. He drops the bloody bat. And that is when he notices the difference. This time, after this extermination, nobody moves. April stares from the doorway. Brian releases his grip on her, and he too gapes. Even Tara, sitting up against the wall across the room, gripped in tears and revulsion and agony, settles into an almost catatonic stare. The strangest thing is, rather than staring at the bloody heap on the floor, they are all staring at Philip. In due course, they put out all the fires and they clean the place up. They wrap the body and move it out into the corridor where it'll be safe until burial. Luckily, Penny witnessed very little of the debacle in the room. She heard enough of it, though, to make her withdraw back into her mute, invisible shell. In fact, for quite a long time, nobody else has much to say either. And the edgy silence continues throughout the rest of the day. The sisters seem to be in some kind of shocked stupor, just going through the motions of the cleanup, not even talking to each other. They have each cried their eyes dry, but they keep staring at Philip. He can feel it like cold fingers on the back of his neck. What the hell did they expect? What do they want him to do? Let the monster feed on Tara? Do they want Philip to try and negotiate with the thing? At noon the following day, they hold a makeshift memorial service in a section of the courtyard surrounded by a security fence. Philip insists on digging the grave himself, refusing assistance from even Nick. It takes hours. The Georgia clay is stubborn in this portion of the state, but by mid-afternoon, Philip is drenched in sweat and ready. The sisters sing David's favorite song, "Will the Circle Be Unbroken," at his graveside. This reduces both Nick and Brian to tears. The sound of it is heartrending, especially as it carries up into the high blue sky and mingles with the omnipresent choir of groaning noises coming from outside the fence. Later, they all sit around the living room, sharing the liquor that they had recovered from one of the apartments and were saving for God knows what. The Chalmers sisters tell stories of their old man, his childhood, his early days in the Barstow Bluegrass Boys Band, and his time as a DJ on WBLR out of Macon. They speak of his temper, and his generosity, and his womanizing, and his devotion to Jesus. Philip lets them talk and just listens. It's good to finally hear their voices again, and the tension of the past day seems to be easing a little bit. Maybe it's all part of their process of letting go, or maybe they just need to let it set in. Later that night, Philip is in the kitchen, alone, refilling his glass with the last couple of fingers of sour mash whiskey, when April comes in. "Look, I wanted to talk to you about what happened and stuff." "Forget it," Philip says, looking down into the caramel liquid in his glass. "No, I should have said something sooner. I guess I was in shock." He looks at her. "I'm sorry I went down like it did. I truly am. I'm sorry you had to see that. You did what you had to do. And I thank you for saying that." Philip pats her shoulder. "I took an instant liking to your daddy. He was a great piece of work. Lived a long, good life." She chews the inside of her cheek, and Philip can tell she's fighting the urge to cry. "I thought I was prepared for losing him." "Nobody's ever prepared." "Yeah, but like this. I'm still trying to wrap my brain around it." Philip nods. "Hell of a thing. I mean, a person doesn't...
You just don't have any reference point for this kind of shit.
I know what you mean. She looks at her hands, which are shaking. Maybe the memory of Philip bashing her father's skull in is still lingering.
I guess all I wanted to say is, I ain't blaming you for what you done.
Appreciate that.
She looks at his drink. We got any more of that cheap wine left?
He finds a little bit left in one of the bottles and pours it for her. They drink in silence for a long while.
Philip finally says,
What about your sis?
What about her?
She doesn't seem to be,
His voice trails off, the proper words escaping him.
April nods. In a forgiving kind of mood?
Something like that.
April gives him a bitter smile.
She still blames me for stealing her lunch money back at Clark's Hill Elementary.
Over the next few days, the new blended family solidifies as the Chalmers sisters go through their grieving process, sometimes arguing over nothing, sometimes giving everybody else the silent treatment, sometimes holing up in their rooms for extended periods of crying or brooding. April seems to be handling the transition better than her sister. She clears out her father's things and moves into the master bedroom, giving Philip the room she originally occupied. Philip sets up a nice area for Penny with shelves and some coloring books he found upstairs. The child is becoming attached to April. They spend hours together, exploring the upper floors, playing games, and experimenting with ways to stretch their meager provisions into nominal yet creative dinners cooked on sterno flames, such as crumbled jerky stir-fry, peach and raisin casserole, and canned vegetable surprise. The surprise, sadly, turning out to be more shredded pieces of beef jerky. Gradually, the hordes of undead drift away from the immediate area, leaving behind only a few stragglers, giving the Blakes and Nick a chance to test the limits of their reconnaissance missions to neighboring buildings. Philip notices that Brian is getting bolder, willing to venture out of the building now and again on quick trips. But it's Nick Parsons who truly seems to be taken to this place. Nick sets up a room for himself in a studio apartment on the second floor, number 2F, at the east end of the corridor. He finds books and magazines in other apartments and drags spare furniture into the studio. He spends time hanging out on the balcony, sketching pictures of the neighboring streets, mapping out the immediate area, reading his Bible, starting a garden for winter vegetables, and thinking a lot about what has happened to the human race. He also completes his ramshackle catwalk between the two adjacent buildings. The narrow walkway is hewn out of plywood and paint ladders lashed together with rope and duct tape, and more than a little praying. The footbridge extends off the back of the roof, spanning a 25-foot gap over an alley and connecting up with the top rail of a fire escape on the adjacent roof. The completion of the catwalk marks a turning point for Nick. Getting up his courage one day, he shimmies across the rickety structure and, just as he had predicted, he makes it all the way to the southeast corner of the block without walking outside. From there, he figures out how to get into the pedestrian bridge to the department store. When he comes back that night with armfuls of goodies from Dillard's, he's greeted like a returning war hero. He brings them fancy gourmet candy and nuts, warm clothing, new shoes and embossed stationery, expensive pens, a collapsible camp stove, satin sheets and luxurious 300 thread count linens, and even stuffed animals for Penny. Even Tara lightens up at the sight of the European cigarettes with the pastel wrappers. And Nick is doing something else on these solo runs. Something that he keeps to himself at first. On the one-week anniversary of David Chalmers' death, Nick talks Philip into tagging along on a little reconnaissance mission, so Nick can reveal what he's been doing. Philip's not crazy about crossing the ladder bridge. He claims he's worried about it breaking under his weight, but the thing that truly bothers Philip is his secret fear of heights. Nick persuades him by piquing his curiosity.
You gotta see this, Philly. Nick enthuses on the roof. This whole area is a gold mine, man. I'm telling you, it's perfect.
With great reluctance, Philip goes ahead and drags himself across the catwalk, on his hands and knees behind Nick,
crumbling all the way, and secretly petrified. Philip doesn't dare look down. They reach the other side, hop down, descend a fire escape ladder, and then slip into the adjacent building through an open window. Nick leads Philip through the deserted hallways of an accounting firm, the floors littered with forgotten forms and documents like so many fallen leaves.
"Not much farther now," Nick says, ushering Philip down a staircase and across a desolate lobby strewn with overturned furniture.
Philip is hyper-aware of their echoing footsteps, crunching over cinders of debris. He feels the blind spots and empty spaces in his solar plexus. He hears every snap and every tick, as though something might lumber out at them at any moment. He keeps his hand on the stock of the .22 thrust into his jeans.
"Over here, right off the parking garage," Nick says, pointing to an alcove at the end of the lobby.
Around a corner, past an overturned vending machine, up a short flight of steps, through an unmarked metal door, and suddenly, almost without warning, the entire world opens up for Philip.
"Holy mother of pearl," Philip marvels as he follows Nick across the pedestrian bridge.
The enclosed walkway is filthy, scattered with trash and reeking of urine, the thick reinforced plexiglass walls so filmed with grime they distort the surrounding cityscape. But the view is spectacular. The passageway is flooded with light and it feels like you can see for miles. Nick pauses.
"Pretty cool, huh?"
"Pretty fucking outstanding."
30 feet above the street, the wind buffeting the structure, Philip can look down and see scattered zombies wandering underneath them like exotic fish drifting below a glass-bottom boat.
"If it wasn't for those ugly motherfuckers, I'd show this to Penny."
"That's what I wanted to show you."